Hello, folks. Welcome to the fourth episode of Anamorphic Podcast. This is the roundtable number two, which was supposed to be between the same original gang that we started with. But unfortunately, the rest of the folks could not make it, so it was just me and Abhinav. So here it is. Check it out.
Hello, folks. It's a line now. Design line. Yeah. And so first one I wanted to talk about is, switching specialization. And a lot of designers go through that, and what happens during that transition, and how should you take up that transition, and what do you think about should one even transition? Is it even worth it? And in what scenarios do you judge this is okay to transition, etc.? Let's start with you.
Cool. So I think transitioning to a UI UX designer, two scenarios, right? One is you're already in a design related field. And the second is you're in a field that's not related to design at all. Like it could be development, it could be in tech, or it could be something totally outside. Like you've done your BCom, or you're in a business role, let's say.
Right.
Or you're in
right.
any type of role and you want to get into design.
Right.
I think in both cases, since design, like this is a thing which I have to keep iterating, which is you don't need a degree for design. Most people don't know that. And even if they do know that, they still believe somewhere deep inside that I don't need a degree, but obviously if I have a degree, I'll be way better than somebody who doesn't have one.
Right.
Which is also not true.
Right.
In the sense that if you look at the way I explain it is if you look at India, if you look at the total number of design colleges, and if you look at what their UX or UI equivalent batches are, and how many students come out every year, it's a few hundred.
Right.
And these people are not prepared for really advanced roles either. Like these people know what they've been taught in college. So self-taught is the way forward. You can transition into UI UX design, whether you're a graphic designer, motion designer, something else in design, or even if you're a developer.
Right.
When you should do it, I think it's a matter of a transition. When we imagine it like this clean line where you're this and then you become this.
Right.
The way to get into UI UX design or any new field actually would be to start where you are already, which is usually we try to look at things from a perspective of I will start it when I get into design college.
Right.
Or when I get a freelance project, maybe then I'll do it. Or when my company gives me the opportunity to do this kind of project, then I will get into UI UX design. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of graphic designers I know who have UI UX design teams in their own company. They really want to do UI UX, but they're like, when I get a chance, I'll do it. Mm-hmm. And I'm really interested. And the point is, dude, if you are really interested, you should be doing it already. You have to start where you are at right now.
Right.
So start small. Build it up. It's like a snowball effect. The longer you take to get into it, and if you just keep thinking about it, it actually gets harder because that's inertia.
Mm-hmm.
You start, if you've been thinking about doing it for a year and you still haven't made any progress, you're going to feel bad, and that's negative inertia.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've been doing small amounts of stuff, you build up, let's say, a small portfolio, you do a few projects, you get some confidence. That's positive inertia.
Right.
So use inertia, start small, and start where you're at. That's what my advice would be.
Right. And I think I want to, for a little while, instead of answering the question, play devil's advocate and go to the other side and kind of try to make sense of what I've heard from designers, right, at different stages of trying to learn design and And from developers, especially the switching role, right? You're switching from non-design. And a lot of them, it seems like, there are hurdles along the way. The first plateau is, should I learn about it? Will I be even good at it? Am I just interested? Then, I decide that I'm interested and I want to get into it. The second question then that comes is, how do I get into it? Then people go, I'll look around and try to make sense of it. And tons of stuff comes up, typically ads from, some institute will come up, and then it looks even more confusing. Oh, then there's certification. And those certifications make it sound even more official that you are now officially certified UX designer, you're officially certified illustrator or graphic designer or whatever field you want to pick up. So it feels like that if there's an official certification that does exist, then that's what industry must look for. But if you try to get into that, then which institute is the best institute, right? Is it any different from what I've learned online all these years? So there's just countless questions after questions after questions and uncertainty and ambiguity, and there's no well-defined path, right? So while I personally take that as, the point of like self-learning is to carve out your own path. But like, I would love to hear, like, how do you, look at that, like hurdles, how should one look at those hurdles and overcome them and think about it?
I think definitely that's the kind of world we live in today. We have a lot of information, right? Mm-hmm. It's not that people lack information. It's that they have so much information. They don't know what they should listen to.
Mm-hmm.
And that is definitely a sort of big problem.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing that I usually tell people is that there is no right path.
Mm-hmm.
Right, which is actually it sounds very simple, but it's actually a big game changer for people when they actually internalize and figure it out.
Right.
Which is, if you want to get into, let's say, IIT,
mm-hmm.
there actually is a right path. There are things that you can do to get in. And right. if you do something else, it reduces your chances of getting in. Mm-hmm. Right. It's probably the same for most things that you've been exposed to at the start of your career. Which is, you think that there is a right path to do things. But the more experience you get, you realize there is no right path, right?
Right.
Because, like, I'll give you an example of Unacademy itself.
Mm-hmm.
So at Unacademy, I've hired, overall, I would say more than 10 designers.
Mm-hmm.
But at any given point of the team, I think I was telling somebody this during an interview as well, which is, we had 8 designers at that time.
Mm-hmm.
One of them had gone to design school. One of them was from architecture.
Hmm.
One was a CA ad before.
Okay.
One of them was a computer science engineer. One was an electrical engineer.
Okay.
It was very diverse. And we had one or two people who actually went to design school.
Right.
And what that just goes to show is there's no one right path. So that actually makes it way trickier, because now you have all this information and you're telling me that there's no right path to do it. Hmm. The point is, you need validation. So as you move in your journey, you need some checkpoints which say you're doing well. And usually institutes help provide that.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are self-learning, set up milestones and checkpoints to keep checking in to make sure you're not slacking off.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever path you are taking, as long as you're hitting certain checkpoints, you're good. And what these checkpoints are, actually, let's talk about that. Right. I would want your opinion on this as well.
Okay.
When starting out as a designer, what are some checkpoints that you think they should, hit?
I think it's very subjective, right? Because what kind of designer you want to become. The only common thing we can, of course, the first kind of checklist you want to build is the technical checklist, right? Let's say you want to become a graphic designer, then you look at all the skill set that you may need for that. And that's where you start from, right? Like, and over time, as you start learning, your checklist will get more refined. Know more things you don't know. You will discover more things you don't understand at all. So I think that's the technical aspect of it. But the non-technical aspect of the checklist will be around first having certain kind of moments, because design is a very, it's taught by experience. You can read 1,000 blog posts and read books about it and take courses, but doing design is doing design. It's really in a weird, awkward space in the head. So I think in that non-technical checklist for me, there would be these couple of experience. First, have hoped for an experience, let's say in your first year, and as soon as possible, as soon as you're able to handle it, an event where there's feedback that completely destroys all your assumptions. Right. Mm. That's the first event I would hope happens with me. The second one that I would hope for is where I am able to observe the user using, you know, the product I'm building or the design I'm working on. So that's the second moment I would hope for. And that's I mean, especially for folks coming in from like a traditional design school, it may sound like, oh, so aren't we going to do research for like every project? So how is that a milestone? But one would be surprised, like, by the reality of that, of what happens there. So a lot of times you just don't have time for research. Like, just to get an example, like right now, COVID-19, scare is going around, and that has impacted travel industry, including Headout a lot, because people are not traveling around. And right now, what our response is, right, as a design team, of what is required and what customers are asking or what they are feeling, we don't have time to like think about, oh, we're going to follow the process of like, okay, let's go down and start research. You have the literature, you have what you have, you make do with the information you have at the moment, because information everywhere like is very little and very scarce. So there's a lot of real life scenarios where you can't just follow the book by the process. So I think hoping for that realization is one of the important things. But the most powerful way to experience that is to notice a customer actually using your product, right, and talking about it when they don't know, maybe that, I mean, where they don't feel watched. I mean, they got to know, because you got to have consent. But at the same time, they got to be comfortable enough where they don't feel being watched, so you can watch them in their natural habitat. So I think at least those would be two a designer should hope for, from achieving the technical aspect they achieve. And the rest is like an artist journey. You know that you're not great at typography, then you want to get better at that. You're not great at, let's say colors, so you want to get better at color combination. Like, I suck at colors. At times, either I'm really good at colors or I suck at colors. That's why my personal website is also all gray. Like, that's what I go for. But when I'm painting or drawing, like, I'm good with colors, right? Like, suddenly, like, all of that is back. So it's very fluctuating. But I know it's been on my personal checklist and what progress I'm making there, right? So I think that checklist is forever. But keeping an active checklist is important. And I've been, I think that idea I've been sharing with a lot of interns as well. What you're talking about, like the moment you go into an internship or join a new job, just go in before getting in with a checklist of what you want to achieve or learn while there. Mm-hmm. And if possible, even share it with your, reporting manager. They would be happy to know, like, what kind of projects you are interested in, what you should be guided towards. So just that simple idea of just making like 10 bullet points, of what you want to sort of learn. So I think that's about the checklist. To get into specifics of like, specific
the kind of checklist that.
Yeah.
I'll also talk about a little about the checklist.
Yes. Yes.
The way I also tell people is it's hard to get lost in the depth of things, which is why it's also probably a good idea to set timelines for certain things.
Right.
So one timeline that I've told a couple people is that if you're getting started in UI UX design today, your timeline should look like this. So within the first week, you should know how to use Figma.
Right.
Right. It only takes a week to learn. It's actually as simple as that. Within the first month, you should be able to make a couple of screens. And by a couple of screens, I don't mean like just two screens. I mean, you should be able to try recreating a variety of screens such that you start understanding the depth of the software, which is what it can do. So that is within 1 month. Parallelly, you should also start reading about what are the different things out there, which is breadth is one, which is, freelancing, you have colors, typography, UI design, UX design, mobile versus web. You have grids, you have so much stuff. And then there's something which is depth, which is actually getting into how do you actually do this one thing really well.
Right.
So as a learner, you have to go breadth as well as depth. But within your first month, first 3 months even, you should be exploring a lot of breadth. Mm-hmm. So booklets.io, the site that I run, that is mostly about showing breadth, which is on this site, for example, you will be able to find snippets of different fields just to understand that there is something called, material design out there. There is something called illustrations, and there are sites where I can get illustrations.
Right.
Or there is something called an 8-point grid. There's something called a 12-column grid.
Right.
Because when you're starting, you don't know what you don't know.
Right.
Right. And that blankness can get intimidating.
Right.
So first 3 months, you understand what the field is. Mm-hmm. Within your first 6 months, get your first project. Mm-hmm. This is either a freelance project. It's a full end-to-end app. Mm-hmm. Either freelance project, I don't think you'll be able to get an internship within this, but it is possible. I know folks who've done it.
Mm-hmm.
Or even if it's a personal project for your case study.
Right.
This first project in your first 6 months of learning design will be an end-to-end thing, which is it's not just a couple of screens. It's a whole system. A user enters here, they do this, they do that. And this first project is probably not going to be very great.
Mm-hmm.
But it's going to be something. And this is going to be your first case study that by month 8, or maybe you are doing this parallelly, this will start, this will be the thing that will sort of be the bedrock of your portfolio.
Right.
Which is normally designers, when they start their portfolio, they have daily UI on their thing, which is they're just doing a bunch of experiments,
right.
Which is also okay. But having real case studies is really good. So this is sort of the milestone that I lay. This is sort of for like the first year. Mm-hmm. But then at the same time, it's tricky because there is no path.
Mm-hmm.
These are milestones. So you might actually do this way faster. You might complete this whole thing in actually just 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And that is okay too. Or it might take you longer based on how much dedication you're actually giving to transitioning into UI UX.
Mm-hmm.
It might not be a full-time effort for you. But that's sort of how I would lay it out.
I think that that's a wonderful framework for people to follow. And that's one question asked like countlessly, like, and that sort of talks about the plateau I was talking about earlier as well.
Mm.
Like, so you have to climb. So it also maps out like in what time should you expect if you give like, you know, full effort to achieve, what can you expect to achieve if you really focus? And that's an interesting thing about design, right? I wouldn't say that, there's any barriers to entry to design. Anyone can learn it, but that's the challenge design poses in front of you as well, that you have to figure your own path out. Even if you're a degree, designer with a degree, sure, the professor and the college will help you figure out the syllabus and how you should think about and give you mental models, but the application of design, right? That's something that you have to learn on by doing like that. There's no two ways about it. And there are folks who are willing to make that effort and see that return, climb that plateau over time. And I think that's, or you're not. And if you want to figure it out, I think that's a brilliant framework. I love that. So have you put that in some sort of visual or like some
capable exercise? Not yet, but coming soon.
I'm pretty sure. So getting into some specifics of, specifically designer to designer transition now, where you're already working, let's say started out as a designer and now you're planning to switch. And one of the most popular ones, I think, is from a graphic designer to a, what they call a UI UX designer, or just being a product designer, interaction designer, or just designing digital products is what their intent is. So why do, in your experience and your conversations with all the designers, why do designers sort of want to do that? And what is then a good reason to do so, and what is not a good reason? And when, like, what path could one follow to, sort of make that progress?
So if you're a graphic designer watching this, I'm going to speak straight to you, right? And you understand what I'm talking about. The day-to-day of your work is either social media posts, it's banners, it's emailers, it's collaterals, which is you're making these collaterals, which you usually at a high frequency, like sometimes every day, sometimes every week, you have to keep making these. And this is actually really fun when you get started out. But after a point, you sort of hit this sort of saturation where you're like, I'm doing the same thing, just slightly different, and I'm doing the same thing every day. A lot of graphic designers don't actually reach this point and they keep exploring even further. And that is also totally okay. But a lot of graphic designers sort of reach this point where they're like, is this all graphic design has to offer? And when you do reach this point, it can be a sign that you're looking for something, for a outlet for your creativity that is outside just social media posts, banners, and collaterals. And the point is also that collaterals are usually one-off things which follow a similar brand style. Versus when you're a UI UX designer, you're creating systems, which is sort of a big leg up from just designing collaterals, because now you have to think at a higher level. So that is actually a big challenge for creativity, because it requires you to think of more variables running together at the same time. So as a graphic designer, if that's a position you're in today, switching to UI UX design is actually a very viable thing for you, and it's going to be super simple for you, because the most challenging thing, which is figuring out tools or figuring out what a design process typically looks like, you already have some idea of that. It's just that instead of designing posters, let's say, you're designing screens. Now, as when designing a poster, there are certain things that go with it, which is the kind of colors you can use, the, let's say, the grid systems for posters, the kind of paper you print it on. Now, these are constraints to your design. For screens, there are other constraints, which is this iOS or Android? What part of the flow is it in? What's the purpose? Is there a, you know, click-through rate you have to think about? So you are just getting used to designing, but for a new medium. This medium now is a digital, it's screens. So as a graphic designer, you're in a very good position. Start figuring out how you can start applying your creativity to this new medium.
Yeah, I think, love that answer, and I completely agree with it. So I'm just going to extend from where you left off. And picking up from, you know, different medium, that's where I see most of the graphic designers trying to switch to, you know, digital designing for digital products. That's where they mostly fall off and not understanding that the aesthetic sense changes, right? So following a similar path of trying to recreate the, you know, UI to understand, to get a sense of pattern. And since you're already a designer, you will pick up those patterns, right? What are the sensibilities of a digital product, and what are the sensibilities of a OS and a platform you're designing for? Is it web? Is it Android? Is it iOS? Is it, what platform are you designing for, and what kind of app you're designing for? You will also start to notice the kind of aesthetics, let's say a utility app has versus, let's say, a game has. And those are very two different kind of aesthetics, you know, you will follow as a designer. So sort of following that same path really helps to pick up on the sensibilities. And another thing I think that I want to really emphasize is the way we think about design when we are graphic designer is like the kind of interaction and distance people are usually used to is very different. I mean, apart from social media posts, because they're consumed on mobile phone. But even there, you're trying to get through a click-through rate, and you know your area of influence is limited. And you don't think about something called states. You know, that's going to be another platform, another pitfall where you're going to fall off. Because we are used to, like, you know, as social media, if you're designing creatives for that, we just put out one creative saying, this is what it is, you know, sale, this is the coupon if you want to follow. But if you were designing that digitally, as a template, as a system, you know, start thinking about systems, then you will need to design how many characters can this line actually hold? How big can the coupon code be? Can you put like currency off or percentage off and those kind of elements, right? So when you start to think about how to templatize, you know, some of your designs, you will sort of start to get an idea of states, right? And states, what states are, for example, let's say you go to WhatsApp, right? What does a contact with whom you do have chats look like versus with whom you've not started chats? So those are two different states of the same element or, you know, thing you're designing. So that is another thing that, you know, I have noticed personally, like graphic designers trying to switch over, like have that aha moment, like, oh, so yeah, that's what I was missing. You know, like that's when there was a lot of back and forth that was happening. And typography, like the type scale practiced in, like, you know, when you're creating, doing print work or social media creative work, even digitally, and the type scale practiced like when doing product design or, you know, designing for digital media. it's very, very different on that platform. So yeah, I think that's specifically about from graphic designers to UI UX designers. And then I think moving on to like a lot of UI UX designers are now getting interested in motion design, you know, and what's up with that. And we also didn't talk about, I think it's important to talk about why, you know, graphic designers are wanting to switch to product design. Why do, in your observation, why do they want to switch?
I think it's just that graphic design can get boring for a lot of graphic designers, which is illustrators I've seen actually usually are really happy with illustrating because there's just so much of, from my opinion, there's so much of depth to explore there. But in most, in a lot of companies, graphic design only means like 2-3 things, right? And that can get very static. So I think the biggest reason is that you get bored of applying your creativity this way and you want to now apply it this way.
Right.
And then another reason then could also be money.
Right.
UI UX designers,
right,
on an average, make a lot more money than UI, than graphic designers.
Right.
So that also can be a big motivating factor.
Right. And another trend I've seen, I think, is that graphic designers, if they want to make the same amount of money, they do well off to be freelancing and consulting. But to run that sort of show is not everybody's cup of tea, because it's really difficult to keep that clients flowing, follow up, and, you know, keep the deadlines yourself. At times you need your, like, you do function better in a, you know, team sort of environment, and that can get really difficult. Speaking of which, you know, you pointed out a very interesting part that it can get boring. And that's why I think at Headout, especially in our discussions of talking about the structure of the team, this is a point as well that came up. And that's where we were very specific about not having a graphic design team, but a visual communication design team, which is broad enough to cover a lot of non-like digital and non-digital, you know, aspects of all sorts of visual communication, including things like iconography as visual communication, right? So that's sort of like becomes a shared sort of, you know, area of like your work goes and becomes like this size of icon, that size of icon. So you're involved in a lot of layers. So right now we have a bunch of interns, but like if you're watching this video and if you're interested in visual communication, should totally apply, because we're looking for folks who are interested in visual communication. Shameless plug, hashtag.
That's very interesting, because for us, what we decided was to actually split the team. And split the team way before it grew. So at some point it was 8 people on the UI UX team and 8 people on graphic design. But we actually split way earlier, where it was about 2 and 2 or 3 and 3. And one of the reasons we did it was just that the pace of work was so different, which is the people who were doing graphics had to do like 2 or 3 things every single day and then 2 or 3 different things the next day, whether this was emails, banners, ads, social media, versus for product designers, they were doing things on a slower time scale, which is maybe in a week you think about this one problem. Or this bigger project that you're working on, which is like about 2 or 3 weeks, maybe.
Right.
So we did that. And then that did cause some problems initially when we split it, which is like coordination. And then, you know, designers like hang out with other designers. You split the teams now and there's less people you can hang out with. But over time, what happened was when the teams grew in size, it actually became all okay. Because then the graphic design team started looking like there were people who were doing just animation. Like just motion design. The people who are doing just, let's say, a lot of design ops work, which is banners and ads kind of stuff. They got much closer with the YouTube team, which was making videos. Because then they started making graphics for a lot of videos. Earlier, the YouTube team used to have difficulty pulling them away from, you know, the product team. And then they got really close with the content teams. They got really close with the academic teams. So eventually that sort of worked out.
Hey, that's kind of a nice idea. I think I'm going to try some of that serendipity, kind of set that up environment for that to happen as an experiment. Because that makes complete sense. You know, the better sense they have of the kind of content that's going in and the kind of you know, who are the people who are using their design and why they really wanted getting them close to that sort of feel. And an interesting thing that is, I mean, we do have that sort of split as well. I mean, there are designers who solely focus on visual communication. But again, the split is between, like, you know, eventually your team evolved to visual communication, which does involve a lot of digital, you know, product design work, or a lot, let's say a lot of work that overlaps multiple mediums, right? Which will be used from a social media creative. And even with social media creative, now we're trying to approach, because the kind of, you know, with multiple languages, et cetera, and kind of experiment that we have to run, we are trying to approach that with the design system point of view as well, where after creating X number of creators, we try to create a system out of it and see if that can be standardized, and then see that humans only need to review for quality standards, right? Once in a while, instead of like sitting down and creating, just removing the, you know, redundancy and manual labor. Yeah. So instead, the graphic designers, or let's say the visual communication designers in our case, are now thinking about what alternate styles could they experiment with, right? How could they, what could they actually test to see whether this works? So we start asking questions from their designs, and, you know, what data they are looking at, and start looking on that trajectory instead of just, you know, being in that circle. It's kind of very difficult, because the requirements in, you know, visual communication are always so unique. Like, this banner never ever looks like that banner, right? But over time, you can roughly develop, you know, a rough sense of things, a starting point at least, which then can, you know, be worked on.
What's also really hard is, as a design manager, it's really hard to give feedback to graphic design teams as well as product design. Because for product design, the kind of feedback you need to give is more systemic, maybe a longer term thing, because their timelines are bigger. Versus for graphic design, feedback is now. You need to do this today.
We had to post this like yesterday. That's always good.
Yeah. And then also another thing that helped for us was moving to Figma, which is initially, since the graphic design team was all using Illustrator, there was a complete disconnect where we didn't know what they were working on. But once they actually moved to Figma, they were like, this is so much better than Illustrator.
Right.
And that's when we started having closer communication, even though we sat apart, because you were all now in the same tool. And that's when they started exploring a lot of design systems. Like, there was this one thing where we had to generate like 1,000 posters with a person's name, with data, how many minutes they watched, and things like that. And since they went Figma, they just used a Figma plugin, connected it to Google Sheets, and just ran this.
Oh, nice.
Right. That's something that would have been much harder.
Right.
Were they not thinking from a, you know, systems perspective?
Right. Hey, I need that plugin, because we have very similar requirements. You gotta link me up, and I'm gonna add the link in the description as well, because I'm pretty sure other folks are looking for that as well. What plugin you could try out and actually use at scale. And moving on to like the next kind of specification, I think was moving to motion design. You know, like, what have you observed has worked out, and where can one start exploring?
So I think with motion design, there's usually two types of motion design that you're thinking about if you want to get into it. One is motion design in apps, which is, let's say micro interactions, button states, mostly micro interactions. That's the category I would put it in. And the second type is actual motion graphics, which is, you want something where there's a bird flying with its wings, right? It's not just a search bar expanding. So for both of these things, firstly, it helps to be very clear which one you want to go into. It's totally different types of motion graphics. If you do want to get into the thing where it's birds, where it's actual motion graphics, where it's like physics you have to consider, the tool of your choice is After Effects. That's the only tool you have to use. Versus if you actually want to get into motion graphics, I mean, if you want to get into motion for product design, then you can actually just use Principle, Protopie, and Figma Smart Animate. This lets you create very simple compositions where you're like state A, state B, and when it goes from here to here, animate it like this. So knowing that these are two categories is actually really helpful. Personally, me, I only know the I only know one of those categories, which is micro interactions. I have no idea how After Effects works. I've actually never used it. But that's what I would tell people. Yeah.
So it's funny because my introduction to After Effects happened when I was exploring with filmmaking, and that's when I learned Premiere Pro as well. I think I was a teenager. So that time I used it for, like, you know, the birds flying kind of tried to use it for that. I was interested to use it that way. And my father even, I think I remember, enrolled me into some animation course, which I never went to for a single day. I just didn't come to me, like, naturally. But years later, like, now to see sort of, like, even, you know, people who were traditionally in motion design of that sort, like animation, which is typically like 2D or even 3D animation, where you would use something like Maya or ZBrush, them trying to sort of think about, now we see them entering the product design world as well, where you see these 3D renders instead of illustrations, which were like 2D earlier. And now you see people doing complex animation on something like After Effects as well, right? But I think anyone who wants to do either one, the first principle that one should understand is how shapes and motion through time actually works, and what stories shapes tell over time when you manipulate them over time, right? And there are some great filmmakers who have done fantastic documentaries online, like on that. And at least that's been my inspiration, right? Like, not that I've done like a lot of product design work, but my framework of looking at them, it has always been in that language. Even when we were trying to design, when we were setting the nomenclature for our design system on how we want to in future lay down animation on that table, it was all based on that kind of, like, entry, stage, exit. So it's just so natural to talk about what's happening on the screen, that a component is entering the screen, what's going to happen. Now it's on the stage, what's happening there, right? What can it do? And how does it exit the stage as well? So it gives you a complete framework on how to think about, what you're looking at on the screen in a completely different way. And it falls in very naturally with sort of systemic thinking from a point of view where you can build complete logic of how this should function. Right, end-to-end logic, and have it completely, like, covered in terms of coverage of all the situations that it can go in. Because think about designing for one video is very different when you're designing a state, let's change in a card size, but let's say somebody taps on it, because you have no idea what goes in that card, right? So if it's colored image, how does it blur? Versus if it's text, does the text disappear? Does it blow up with the card? Like, there's a lot of things that you will need to consider in, right? And understanding basics of animation or 2D animation, traditional or filmmaking, really, really helps you understand and gives you a framework of, how to sort of think about product animation or just digital animation or micro interactions. Yeah, that would
be. And I think even between the two, like between motion graphics and motion in UI design, with motion graphics, your output is going to be a video.
Right.
That's usually not great for micro interactions versus what you actually want is motion and UI. Your output is actually a prototype where you can play around with it. And here you can actually see that as your finger moves up, the animation is slowly happening. So it's not just time. Then there's also like this action involved with it.
Right. Right.
And then there's this really good quote, which says that in your Figma file, you have screen A and screen B, but at 60 FPS, there's 60 states that you need to design between that screen A and screen B.
Right.
So that's the importance of motion and UI design, which is users don't look at it as screen one and screen two. They look at it as this one continuous space where things just happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that sort of sets the stage of the language one starts to think about that, what is happening on the stage. And I think I was reading this in Taruna Manchanda's blog post on Swiggy Pop. One of the favorite lines of one of their, I think, VPs is "customer ko kya dikhega," right? What will the customer see? So I think that's a very good framework to sort of start looking at motion design as well. I mean, one would say like that's what designers do, but no, like, at times you're designing things that maybe no one will see, but motion design is really about what people will continuously see, as a factor. There's no, same thing, I think we were talking about in a design case study that we were doing on your channel, that that months exist in our head, the time runs continuous, so you can't just design logic for a month in at times in just as whole unit. You can't break it down like that. And the same way time, you know, we divide two screens, but you can't just cut it out like that because time is continuous. You know, there's the device still exists, the user still exists as the screen is like, and as an experience designer, as a motion designer, you have to worry about what happens then.
For sure.
And I think it started with the skeletal animation, loading animations, where those kind of things are coming in. But yeah, I think that was whatever we have moved for good into really thinking about, you know, how to use motion as a form of communication. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a good time to a natural thing to move into this, the next big question, which was around multidisciplinary designers, you know, and how what is your experience around, like, does that eventually happen? Is it inevitable? Or do you have to make it happen? And how is it? Is there any benefit to any losses? And what does it even mean to be multidisciplinary designers? And most of us multidisciplinary eventually?
Yeah, so I would say as a designer, you'd probably identify with one of two types. You're either a generalist or you're a specialist. Most people, or actually every single person, is either a generalist or a specialist. And the difference is here. Now, a specialist, for example, would be somebody who's really good at, let's say, illustrations, really good at motion design, really good at UX research, really good at, let's say, visual design, really good at prototyping. But they don't do anything else. They only do the thing that they're really good at. And everything else, they either don't know or they never do it. That's what a specialist is. A generalist is somebody who's sort of like a full stack designer, where you know all of these parts. Now, of course, even here, you might have your strengths and your weaknesses. But in every single project, you end up doing all the steps involved. Now, depending on whether you're a generalist or specialist, the kind of stuff you do changes wildly. Or based on the kind of stuff you want to do, you should make up your mind which of the two you want to become. Because for freelance work, if you want to be a freelancer, you cannot be a specialist. You need to be a generalist. Because people are not going to, they're not going to hire you to just do, or actually for some specialists, I agree. Let's say illustration, motion graphics. But typically you can't just do wireframes, for example. You can't just do low fidelity and research and be like, that's it. Freelance usually requires you to do like the full app or the full feature. Or even at startups, usually early stage or early up to mid stage, they usually hire more generalists than specialists. And only when the team starts scaling, which is like beyond, let's say when you reach 8 to 10 people, that's when you start hiring specialists. So based on the kind of work you want to be doing, you should make up your mind whether you want to be a generalist or a specialist. Of course, most designers are good at multiple things, but the point of a generalist or specialist is, do you want to do all of those things or do you want to just do one of those things?
Mm-hmm. I think I love that framework and that vocabulary as well, and completely agree with that. Just want to cut it different way, which is, you know, how I view it, like even to the paths to being a specialist is laid down with being a lot of generalists a lot of times. In, you know, sort of the only difference, therefore, in what we perceive to be generalists and specialists must be that your choice and, you know, how narrow do you cast your, you know, net in sort of speak of what you want to learn. So if you just get heavily bent on, okay, I want to like really act as generalist in just talking about graphic design, right? So then you have to learn about color, type, size, different kind of mediums, right? So you'll have to be a generalist, a specialist a lot of times, and in therefore in a larger, broader sense, being a generalist to just be eventually be a specialist, you know, in something like a graphic design. And the same applies for, like, you know, UX researcher who are consultants. It's they are far and few, but I mean they exactly deliver that at times. All they do is just deliver research and, you know, findings of what they've done, and their agencies whom companies hire for that. But that bar is set really high, that you have to be really strong specialist. And that thing you're talking about of freelancer expecting end to end stuff also applies there. There you can't just interview people and go like, yeah, I spoke to people. Now, where's the report? I mean, it doesn't work that way, right? It wouldn't function. So So there are those sort of layers, you know, like as you go, as the scale increases, like you and adding the same point you're talking about, just turning it around, not of the team, but of the problem you're looking at. That also warrants adding more specialists and, you know, adding more. Two are related, because as your company and the problem scale increases, you will add, that's when you will add people to the team. But that's sort of what, you know, causes it to happen, because let's say you're working in video a lot, right? Your company works in video a lot. Then eventually you will start to go towards designers who sort of have done that work and sort of specialize in that or are interested in that sort of field. So it's naturally tends to happen. But to get there, I think is important. You have to realize that you have, if you do decide to be a generalist, then realize that you will completely change domains. You know, as you're working on, as earlier we're talking about going from graphic design to suddenly going to product design, right? That's sort of a mind of a generalist. And then being specialist is doing the same sort of thing, but in a very narrow window, right? And getting really like the same width and breadth sort of thing, you know, depth sort of thing we were talking about earlier, that you see a variety first, you know, if you like variety, then maybe being a generalist will be a great idea, where you know something about everything, right? Or you go the other way, where you know everything about something, right? So that's sort of the two ways you can go about it. And honestly speaking, like, naturally you will find yourself being in both, but what we're talking about here is what does 90% of your time at work or in your work goes into. Like, is it switching context a lot of times? Then your job does require to be a journalist, or does it go into deeper into the same problem that you're looking at, right? Then your mind requires you to be very heavy specialist.
Yeah. And I think in general, usually when people talk about generalist and specialist, they don't talk about it within design.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they talk about it in terms of, I can do marketing development as well as this thing. But if you're talking just about design, also the number of jobs, like this is something that if you're listening right now, you can quickly open a new tab, go to LinkedIn, go to jobs, search for product designer, UI designer, UX designer. You're going to find a few thousand results. You're going to find 3,000 to 6,000 job listings versus search for things like motion designer, illustrator, UX copywriter. You're going to find a few hundred jobs, right? I did this just today, actually, preparing for our roundtable. But that's a similar scene in freelancing as well, which is there will be more people looking for general design work, lesser people looking for very specific. So that's something worth thinking about. Like, you can interpret that in many different ways, actually.
Yeah, I think that's a very good picture of the economics of the market as it exists. That the more you can sort of cover in the project, and the less, those sort of companies are more, or that sort of work is more out there in market than people who exactly know what they want from you, and they have got the rest of it figured out themselves. Those are far and few, right? I think that's very well. I think that those are a lot of nice frameworks to sort of look at that, multidisciplinary designer point of view. And coming to now, talking about some moments, emotional moments of being a designer. I think I especially wanted to cover starting with one failure that you felt in the gut, so to speak, right? And you get to pick whichever one you want.
I'll talk about some of my solo experience.
Right.
There have been about one or two times where I've had real issues doing long-term freelance projects, right? And this is something that I only realized much later, which is there was this one time where I was doing a design project where there was a website that needed to be designed, the branding that needed to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a Mac app that needed a redesign. So I, of course, started with the branding, did a few concepts, then moved on to the website. Now, even in the website, there's the homepage, which is most important. And then there's all other pages. So I ended up doing the homepage and then started a little bit on the Mac app design.
Mm-hmm.
And then within this, like, this itself took 2 months. And this was supposed to be like a 1 month project or something. And I didn't estimate really well.
Mm-hmm.
But then the project actually ended up going really badly.
Mm-hmm.
We terminated midway. I only got paid like maybe the I think we settled on like 30-40% of the total thing. And then I was just like, what a failure. Like that was a really big failure for me because it was a really good project. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of scope to do something very, very cool. Mm-hmm. But then in hindsight, right, my learnings, my takeaways from that was me personally, I find it really hard to do long-term projects where I'm doing the same thing over and over. So at Unacademy, for example, as the head of design, this was actually really good because I got to do a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. Designers are working on a lot of different projects, a lot of different feedback to be given. And then there's things to handle, which just keep getting thrown at you. Mm-hmm. Like I'm really good in that kind of environment. But I realize I'm not good at an environment where I have to do the same thing over a long period of time.
Right.
So how I would have done it differently is probably instead of taking up all three of these things, I would have said, okay, I'm only going to do your homepage. And as part of this, I will do some branding concepts that you can then expand on. But I have a big problem saying no to things. Right? And it's really bitten me in the ass before.
Right.
Yeah.
Very interesting. I think that makes me want to share like two different flavors of failures. And one that sort of like leads to pain and one that sort of leads to like eventual, bliss or like success. One is like when I was running this UX design agency with my co-founder, we had this big ass client, like very popular brand. And we were working for them trying to develop this website. And we worked like day and night across, we used to have a remote team. So we worked like for about 2-3 months overnight. Like they would send a heavy list of changes, like 25-30 bullet points of changes. We'd do that and then they would change their mind and we'd do that, and that went on for like 3 months. And we really wanted to do it because we were like, how can we not get it right? Right, like A, ego, and B, we were like, it's a really big client, like if we are able to pull it off. And they were paying us shit, really bad money, like really way little money than we would expect except from anyone. And that's what is true about most brands, because they are bigger brands. They pay far less. They try to negotiate more. And we really wanted to do it because, it was a big brand and we wanted that on our portfolio. Yeah. So in the end, we just finally gave up because they were like, after 3 months of, doing iterations, then they started delaying on us. Like they would start delaying feedback for a week. And no, we're not sure about the project. So after doing like 3 months of iteration, and we broke our own rule, like guide the client through iteration. But we were like, okay, they are like big company, like, they would know what they're doing. But turns out they didn't know shit, right? They didn't know what they were looking for. And by looking at so many choices, they got even more confused, which is typically what happens. And it's in that sort of role, it's very important for you to guide the client. So that was one sort of failure, which we just quit. We were just like, forget about it. Like, forget the money, forget the client. It's over. So that ended in sorrow. But another sort of failure happened at, me and the product manager was working it with back then, and Instamojo, we sort of were working on a new homepage and we did our like fancy stuff. We went through our keyword research, this and that, and we came up with a nice new concept for a homepage and how it will extend to different landing pages and how it was really cool, like what we were up to. But then this new product manager comes in who's been like talking to customers like for a month, and he rips it apart in a meeting. Like he rips it apart. Like who wants to know this? No one cares. I just want to know like this. Like give me this 1, 2, 3. I haven't got time for anything else. And just hammering down customers' perspective. And in between, like the product manager working with me, he got like a little charged up and going like, yo, like I was like, chill. Like let's hear him out. And that's the first time I felt what accepting feedback feels like, I think, consciously. Because earlier, there was always a layer of like, okay, it is feedback about the work I've done. But I think this is the time the feedback was so brutal, right? And so on point that there was no way for me to even for a moment to feel conscious that it all became about the customer. And I just wanted to hear somebody just, if they're ranting, it felt like the rant of the customer, because that's what I have heard. The kind of things when I went and spoke to the customers. So I think that eventually led us to completely changing the entire concept, throwing everything away, starting from scratch and developing something that became like a foundation for like, even till today, that is sort of the framework. Mm. instruments is sort of at least follows on their homepage. So that was sort of, you know, like a failure, I would say, that led to like much bigger success. And that's I wish had happened more often. I think the last one I really want to talk about is what projects you're working on and why. And this could be like about side projects. I mean, for me, it may revolve around side projects. Your now side projects are the main projects. So what are you working on and why?
So let me give some context to build up to the why,
right,
which is I want to talk about one of the moments of success that I went through that really changed my perspective. And this was when I first made money on the internet through something I had built.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So this was somewhere around a couple of years back. Maybe I would say it was 2014 or 2016 probably.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I did was I made this online course on Principle. It was called, it's still out there. You can search it. So if you search for Principle for Mac, one of my articles, Medium articles, is one of the top results. And at the bottom, you'll find a link to the ebook.
Mm-hmm.
But this was a sort of like an ebook that I had made. It's like an online course about how to learn Principle for Mac. And it's called The Designer's Guide to Motion in App Design. So it talks about some of the principles of motion, what you should consider, states, things like that. And then it gets into how do you actually make these things with Principle.
Mm-hmm.
So I made this. It took me about a month to make the whole thing. Mm-hmm. It was not very video heavy. It's more text with visuals heavy. And I did very little promotion for it, looking in hindsight compared to what I'm doing now. But it's made a few $1,000s. So it's made about $4,000 to $5,000 so far. And like within the first few days, it made about $1,000.
Nice.
And that was actually a big shift for me because I knew I had wanted to do something which is like new stuff. But to me, it always looked like doing new stuff always looked like doing a startup, which is raising money for it, going after this crazy huge problem, which is like, I want to do food delivery. I want to do e-commerce. And something like this, which was as niche as, you know, using Principle to make animations in your app.
Right.
Made me a couple $1,000s. So that was a big shift for me. And I always knew I could do it. It's just that I'd never proven it. And I'd seen people do it as well with different fields, but I'd never proven it to myself.
Mm-hmm.
But so once I'd done this, then I realized that was the value of side projects,
right,
which is, I think a lot of designers look at side projects as freelance projects. So firstly, freelance projects, they're not side projects. Mm-hmm. It is you are doing stuff on the side. But when I say side projects specifically, it's your side hustle, yeah. But side projects are something that you're doing on the side, which is your own thing.
Mm-hmm.
So today, the kind of projects I'm working on, I've basically used that sort of formula, which I first figured out in 2016, applied to a lot of projects. So now all my side projects are actually now my main projects.
Mm-hmm.
And they all make money. So now some of the projects I'm working on, the way I describe this best is at the top level, it's 10kdesigners.com. That's the overall umbrella company movement, which all these products fall under.
Hashtag brand.
That's the brand, yeah. The idea of 10K designers is that I want to create 10,000 new designers, not just by myself, but through this whole network, through all the people who are going to be involved. So even you, for example, Siddharth, you're a part of this 10K designers because you're going to take a big chunk of that away from me. Right? And the main reason was that I know design schools are not producing enough designers.
Yeah.
The future of design is self-taught designers.
Yeah.
And now the products I have under this, UI Sources is number one. That's basically a design repository site to find micro interactions.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say you're working on... you want to find some onboarding screens. You want to find gamification. You want to see examples of how different apps do different patterns.
Mm-hmm.
You can sort of use UI Sources to figure it out. That's probably the biggest right now. So it does about 150,000 monthly sessions.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the biggest. The second thing is the YouTube channel, of course. You'll find me in one of the comments below. So you can...
I'll link to the channel as well. Come on.
Yeah. And then booklets is something I launched very recently. And one of the reasons I did that was the YouTube channel, people are learning design through it. UI source is a little bit more advanced. Beginners typically don't understand what to do with it. But booklets is a way to learn the breadth of design, which is you want to understand a little bit about pricing. You want to understand branding, freelancing, graphic design, UI, web, mindset, process. So it's got small bite-sized content that you can check out. So that just launched maybe a few weeks back. So I'm waiting to see how that picks up. And then there's a podcast coming up as well.
Yes, finally.
So this is going to be sometime this month that it comes out. It's called whiteboard.fm. So we'll talk about that in the future.
Okay.
So these are currently, and then of course there's a separate thing of projects that I'm not ready to talk about yet, which is still under 10K designers. Some of it's slightly outside it, but that'll be revealed over time. Yeah.
So we have just the perfect teaser, just the perfect and well-practiced teaser. love that show. You should be in showbiz, yo. Like, I mean, you are with YouTube. Like, totally made for it. So adding to, what projects I am working on, what side projects I am working on. I think the blog and the earlier, for the longest time, just laying down a foundation of how I came about it was my failed attempts at trying to create multiple apps, some for myself, which were a little too complex either, or like I just didn't get enough time to focus on them because there's just too many when you're trying to build an app, including back end, front end, writing code and design. It's just too many layers to traverse. So that sort of like went on for like, I don't know, about 2-3 years. And I tried to make multiple apps. Some I used for a bit after making them, but like abandoned later on because there were other tools. Like something like Notion came up where building something quick, even of functionality, or something like Airtable, which where it's really quick. So that sort of faded away. But meanwhile, what I did realize that a lot of write-ups and, you know, stuff that I'd done earlier sort of started circling back in, you know, multiple ways where, and the folks I had gone to college to speak to, you know, I keep going to college to speak. So I got gone to one college and a bunch of them started reaching out now from the startup industry. So that sort of is very nice to know that, you know, some people did make that move in multiple different ways and are doing well now in what they're trying to learn. So that sort of becomes a motivational push and you realize, oh, there is value to what you can, you know, putting your story out there. And or just being in public and learning what you're learning and, you know, talking to, sharing your work out there in public. And so over time, I think just documenting work and helping other people document their own work and their own ideas, sort of just looking at that in a way has like now put me onto treating my YouTube as a side project, right? Or treating the kind of experiments I want to do on TikTok as a side project. The kind of news, I just started a newsletter and podcast. That's also like, you know, massive side projects that are going to eventually evolve. And just sort of those, and beauty is here now, they connect very well with the work because they sort of overlap in what I do is what I talk about. And, you know, what I discuss, what other people do is what I discuss with them. But I, in finding that sort of alignment in goals was just something that was fascinating. And there, like you said, like there are always other side projects that you're always working on or thinking about that you're not ready to reveal or talk about yet. And but there's one that I really wish to eventually get down to building, which is just a resource site for students, especially at the end of all the talks. I want to give out the URL as a as a call to action or a CTA. Just has a lot of list of various aspects of, you know, different things that you, mental models that you should pick up in life. Like, let's talk about personal finance. Let's talk about this. And instead of me creating all that content, some of it, I will obviously will, like, let's talk about design or product. I will be creating, linking up to my content as well. But just linking to articles, videos, films, resources that sort of like cover, help me think about or get to that. Like, let's say if I learned double entry accounting, where did I learn that? Just sort of like building a personal resource site, which I think will be a fun project. I haven't gotten started with that yet, but I have drawn just like, I had diagrams multiple times trying to dissect and bisect in different ways.
Nice.
So, yeah. Why I do it is, again, coming back to seeing that value you know, of seeing those stories, of being part of somebody else's story, for you know, giving that, being part of an important time in their life when they were trying to take that decision, and having any influence at all and any help at all in people trying to come to startups, trying to become designers, trying to become whoever they are, like whatever help. Like that's been my agenda for the longest time, even like 10 years ago, that was my agenda of like, become what you want to become. And even today, that is the agenda, like all these side projects revolve around. So yeah, that's what the side projects I'm working on.
Yeah. Yeah, to close the loop, it's almost like, you know, in the beginning of the episode, we talked about there's so many paths out there. There's no correct path.
I saw it coming.
And I think the best path, like each of us, we are going down our own paths. So we technically are the paths. Mm. We're like these living paths that people can actually look up to, because it's had an effect on me as well. Like if I don't personally think I can do something, but then I see somebody else, a friend of mine, who's doing the exact same thing, it sort of motivates me, which is like, if he can do it, of course I can do it as well. Mm-hmm. So the best way to actually find paths is to find somebody who is just like yourself, who's doing things you want to do, mm-hmm. and then backtrack from there and figure out, okay, where am I right now and where do I want to go?
Yeah. And I love that. I think that's the best closing line we can have. And that sort of summarizes all sort of things we talked about. Make some designer friends, or make some engineer friends, or whatever you're trying to become, most likely designers if you're watching this. So make designer friends, make people who do that sort of work, and see what happens. Awesome. And that was a wrap.